I go home and I start stripping. Now I'm hanging out with this girl. She's telling me I ain't shit. I'm dancing in front of 300-400 women.
They're now, are you dancing because of the money, because of the adulation? You get off on it? Like, what is it about?
First, I had dropped out of school and I hadn't done anything. I was like, this would be a great.
So you needed the money. Yeah, so you needed the money.
Yeah. Okay. And I wasn't doing nothing. My mom, I'm sitting on the couch. I'm depressed about this kid. I do it. But then there's this disconnect between women chanting my name. So my stripper name was Prince Mandingo, right? So I know people use that as a terminology now, but I was the first guy. We're talking about 89, 88.
Hey, folks, before we get into the podcast, August 18th, I'm going to be doing a special show at the Glastonbury Theater in Glastonbury, Connecticut. So come check it out. We've got a great venue. Should be a fun night. It's a Friday, and it's part of a two-day festival there. So come check it out. That person you heard is Dante Nero, my good friend, great comedian. We work together in New York, and he's got a terrific podcast. And him talking about how he became a stripper, and he stripped for 11 years, and there's a whole lot more. It's a pretty amazing backstory that is funny and unbelievably believable at the same time, and it's really, really fun. And I actually, to make money, tried stripping, and the music was turned off, and everybody in the audience voted for me to stop. So. And to give them money back for seeing what they had to see for that couple of minutes. So I actually lost money. I think I'm the only guy that's stripped and lost money. But enjoy Dante Nero. Hope to see you guys in Glastonbury, Connecticut, August 18th. And check out Dante. Here he is.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Very special guest this week. My good, good, dear old friend. I don't mean old, like in age, like he's old. I just mean long time. Really great guy. Really funny bastard. Just a killer, killer comic. Dante Nero. What's up, buddy?
What's going on? I'm kind of old, too. But a little bit of both. I always say I've seen more sunsets than I'm gonna see, so you know.
That's no, you're look at you. You're in amazing shape. We go way back from doing stand up in the city together, and I said to you, I was just on your podcast. 202 Man School and Man School 202 rather. And by the way, Dante's got a terrific podcast, Man School 202, which you have to listen to. It's about relationships. He gives consultations. You've seen him on Comedy Central, on HBO. You've seen him on everything. And also a great actor, too. You've been in some badass movies.
Thank you, man.
So we're going to talk about Man School 202.
Okay.
And right. And what you do with that. But how you got there is really interesting to me. And what I try to do on the podcast is kind of give people... talk about people's process, how they do what they do, but like why they ended up there. And there's always a backstory that leads to what people do and how you ended up getting into being able to not just be killer funny, but like relationship advice that really is good. Like it's from a person that actually has had relationships, who's fucked up relationships. Cause we're all fucked up and we all fuck up relationships. But you were like a kid, and I know we talked about this, and you got hooked on comedy like I did. Yours was like Richard Pryor and Red Fox and some of those guys, right?
It's funny when I say that, I was the kid who, you know, Letterman, not even Letterman, Johnny Carson. Yeah. My family was watching Johnny Carson, and they would put me to bed, and then I would sneak up the stairs and then peek through the crack in the door and just to see the stand-up comedy. So like, it's funny because I was so into it. Like, I remember names like Gary Mule Deer and Jake Johansson
there was a Johnny Carson on the other night because it's on Antenna TV Network and it was Barry Sobel's first appearance on the show.
That's crazy. Yeah.
So now what hooked you about it? Because the same thing happened to me. I used to beg my parents to stay up to watch comedy. Like, what was it, do you think, in looking back, in retrospect?
I was funny. It was just so much joy, making people laugh. My dad was 5'2". never was more than 145 pounds, but he had this huge personality and he would always joke and tease and stuff like that. He was also a guy who did youth work from like 1935, like when he was in World War II. He was always into something, like he did a
in Brooklyn, with, right? You guys are from Brooklyn, well, yeah, born and raised.
Yeah. He was initially from Harlem, then Queens, and then I was a Brooklyn boy the whole right. time. My 16 brothers and sisters, 8 boys, 8 girls. And when he went to World War One, him and his brothers went to World War One, and he organized boxing exhibitions with Joe Louis in World War One. And then when he came home, he would do women's basketball. He would do all kinds of tournaments and stuff.
How did he connect with Joe Louis? How did that happen?
Just Harlem. You know, he was like a personality in Harlem, and it just, you know, these were just people that you knew. My papa was always a real big personality kind of guy. And he just always, as long as I can remember, he knew people. You know, he just, like, as a kid, we would go for ice cream and people would yell. Like, we could never get there because people would stop him to talk to him. You know, like,
I remember like the mayor being of the neighborhood, right? Like the mayor of the neighborhood.
I remember being 15 and they had a wall with like Nelson Mandela and Shirley Chisholm and Muhammad Ali. And he was next to Mandela and Dinkins. Like he had a picture up on the wall. They actually named a park and a street after him at the old Dodger Stadium, Ebbets Field in Brooklyn.
Wow. He was
a real prominent dude, just a prominent Brooklyn dude, you know?
You had 16 brothers. I never knew that about you. Was it all from the same parents or is it a mixed family?
His eight boys and 8 girls they had. I mean, you know, my dad was the youngest of 16, born in 1920. So that's just kind of what they did, you know?
Oof. Yeah, I'm Italian Catholic, but we didn't do that. That's insane. Yeah. That's like, you guys are like taking it another knot. You're just showing off like how much sperm you guys have, like active sperm.
Also because you're talking about, you know, we're literally talking Jim Crow time. And so all the kids worked and they worked. And like, I remember him telling me that he used to do pick up scrap metal and whatever, you know, like they all had jobs just to survive. It was weird because, I mean, you kind of create more mouths to feed. So my grandfather was actually a bootlegger. Who was a train porter, you know, when you had all black train porters and he used to take the train up to Canada. And my grandmother had this huge, sewed this big overcoat with these pockets and he would put 16 bottles of Canadian hooch and he would bootleg down during that, you know, prohibition and shit. So. Yeah.
Did your family, your parents, your father must have experienced racism and all of that? And like,
it's Jim Crow. We're talking about Jim Crow. You know, I mean, I definitely feel like, you know, all of his brothers and him were in the army and they were, you know, their thought was we'll go to the army and then serve as patriots and then they'll know that we deserve to be here, which. You know, we know how that turned out with the GI Bill and all of those things that they promised people, the redlining and, you know, all of that scrap that was going on. But that was kind of as a black family, that was the thing. It was like, we're going to be the best of what we could be. And then they won't have any choice but to accept you. But that really wasn't in the cards in the first place. What you're asking people to do is to relinquish power and privilege when they don't have to, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, who does that, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, you do that when you're mature and you're at it's a moral dilemma. But I mean, even then, it's like, why would I give my privilege up, you know?
Yeah. So what did he teach you in terms of how to deal with racism? And because I'm sure you've seen it over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, he was an older guy. I mean, he was, you know, like, he's the youngest boy of 16. So my oldest grandmother was born 18, my oldest aunt was born in 1896. So, you know, we're talking about an array of 20 years of kids. And I mean, the thing with us was just, you just had to know, you get to talk. You know, every black child knows you get to talk when you speak to cops. Yes, sir. No, sir. Oh, do what they say. Shut your mouth. Do whatever they say. Stay alive. That kind of thing. What's interesting is the way that they perceive that police brutality is perceived now. Imagine what it was when there were no, there were no cameras, no accountability. I mean, realistically, I'm a big history buff. I mean, the first time that a cop was actually taken to account for killing an unarmed black man didn't happen until 2016. That's the first time that cops were held accountable, and we're talking about unarmed. So, you know, so that's a hop, skip away, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And did you like, but so, you know, you're getting to be an older kid and all of that. I come from a pretty blue collar family. I know you do, kind of like entertainment is not something that they think about, right? They want you to get a good education and go the next level that they didn't go. Like, were you guided a certain way?
I went to school. You were supposed to go to college, you know, there would be education. But my dad had an eighth grade education. My mom had a sixth grade education. So it was just, both my sisters went to college and got masters. One of them had two masters. One of them had, and another one had, both two of them had two masters. Mm-hmm. And so I went to school. I went to SUNY New Paltz. I went to college, but it wasn't.
We'll talk about that because you went on a fencing scholarship.
Right. So my dad worked for the parks department.
And you don't have the body of a fencer. I'm sorry, I gotta tell you right now.
Not now.
You're like, so would you just not really fence? Would you like point the thing and then just get the guy in a headlock?
Well, you know, it was weird because at the time I played rugby, I played football, and fencing was something that I took up so my dad worked for the parks department. There was a guy who actually was first black guy who was supposed to go to the Olympics in 73, popped his Achilles heel, and then ended up taking a civil service job. His name was Bill Cantrell. And he taught inner city kids fencing. So I took it when I was like about 9, 10, and I loved it. And so it was just easier for me to get a scholarship because there wasn't a lot of black fencers.
Why did you take fencing? Like, what was it at that age where you just thought it was cool? Or
Robin Hood, like, you know, Errol Flynn and watching that stuff. Somebody was like, yo, you want a sword fight? And I was like, yeah, well, who doesn't want to fucking, I mean, what kid didn't sword fight, didn't pick up two sticks fight, you know?
Yeah. So, and I don't get, and I'm not going to get arrested for this. You don't get arrested for it either. That's a win-win, right?
Oh, yeah. So when did we not poke each other in the eye with a stick? I mean, that was a thing that we did. So, so it was just something I took up and I got really good at it. And I was able to get like 2 years in college from it. Yeah. You know, I got to have partial scholarship. I loved doing it. It was a lot of fun. But my dad was such a big personality. And then he promoted a basketball tournament. So in Brooklyn, like we couldn't go anywhere without him getting stopped and talked to and stuff like that. And I just didn't want to be in his shadow, you know. Like,
I was going to ask you, was it hard to share him like that?
Yeah. And then he was like Mr. Basketball. He actually started a tournament called the 6 Foot and Under Tournament. So if you were over 6 foot, you couldn't play. Hmm. He invented that. And so what you had was the gameplay was really crazy because you had a bunch of point guards playing basketball together, you know, sort of really fast and, you know, and you got guys who are 6 foot who can still dunk, you know? Yeah. So, you know, he did that because he was 5'2", you know? So, you know, that's, and I'm 6'1", which means they put steroids in the chicken. So,
or he's not, He's not really your father, and he had no son.
Maybe not, but we look a lot alike.
Your mom banged a forward instead of a point guard.
It was weird because I just wanted to be not in his shadow, so I fenced because he didn't fence. I rode a unicycle. There was a unicycle in the house that we bought, and he asked, brought it up. I taught myself how to play a unicycle. I played a little bit of basketball, but being his son and playing basketball would be like being Jordan. Yeah. You know, so I didn't want that. He boxed. I did martial arts. And just everything he did, I did the opposite.
What did martial arts teach you? Other than the physical aspects of it, but what did it? I did karate for a while, but not. I don't think I got as far as you did in it. You really advanced in it.
Well, I used to fight. Like, so my dad was super protective. I mean, I think that comes from him, you know, growing up in Jim Crow, was always worried. But I mean, not just about cops and racism and stuff like that. I mean, that was a big thing, but it was also drugs, and it was about, you know, you're born 1920, but he was afraid of, I mean, imagine growing up in Brooklyn and Crown Heights, Brooklyn in the 70s and 80s. Heroin and then crack. And then, I mean, I so often think I wonder how I survived. The fact that I survived was amazing. I mean, it's one of the things that I say is like, you remember when they had the Beats headphones and these kids were running around with these Beats headphones? There was no way you could walk around with $400 headphones with a discernible red cord, and we knew you had what you would get robbed.
You would get like three steps.
I did whatever dirt I did, but I was never a thief. But if I saw you wearing a $400, I would rob you as a favor to you. You're like, are you out of your mind? You know, but I'm doing you can't do this. Even when we had iPods, not iPads, but iPods, we would take the white cord and change it for the cheap headphones, because if they saw the white headphones going in your head, you'd get robbed. You couldn't even do that. It was insane. I remember going, there was a club I used to go to in Brooklyn, right on right next to the botanical garden, called Love People. It was on Washington Avenue. They used to shoot up in that club so much that they would shoot up, people would hit the dirt, and then if nobody got shot, they would just keep dancing. They would get up and start dancing. It was insane, just insane. But the fight, I took, my dad was like overprotective. You get killed, you're gonna catch them on, you get hit by a car, I grew up as a scary kid. I was afraid of everything, afraid of girls, afraid to fight. But I was also kind of
wait. You? I don't see.
Yeah, but, yeah. Yeah, I was.
Because you weren't kind of the muscular guy. I was a little guy.
My dad was 5'2", so I was a little guy. I didn't get a growth spurt until probably junior and senior year of high school. So I was a little dude. I started lifting weights, but I was still a little dude. I remember him meeting people, and they would be like, "Man, he's getting tall. He's almost he's gonna be a shrimp like me." He used to always say that. And then, but he was afraid of everything. I was a scary kid. I remember I was third grade. My bully's name was John Sheed. And he would take my French fries and fuck up my lunch and take it. It was just so, but I was one of those kids that would get that done, and then I would not sleep for 2 weeks. Just think, running it over in my head.
What were you thinking? Run it over, like, I should have done.
I should have did this. I should have hit him. I should have did this. And then maybe like in fourth grade, I did. Like, he said something and I clocked him. And the feeling of just taking charge of that was like, oh my God. Now, it didn't all change, but I remember that feeling. And then I might have had another situation in fifth grade where I had another situation, and then I fought back. And then I was leaving school, going to high school. I went to Brooklyn Tech. And I was pretty sharp, and I passed for Brooklyn Tech.
Yeah, that's
I got
a good
into
school.
Bronx Science and Brooklyn Tech.
Wow.
I wanted to go to Stuyvesant. I didn't have the grades for Stuyvesant. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Brooklyn Tech, and I was like, okay, I could be whoever I wanted to be, because nobody knew me from. And I went to Brooklyn.
Wait. So you mean you could be who you really were and didn't have to hide your fears? And
they're right. I whatever the perception was about me being a pushover, a guy who you could take advantage of. When I went to high school, I made a concerted effort that I would not let anybody take advantage of me. And
did you go the other way and become sort of a bully yourself a little bit?
No. In fact, I fought a lot of bullies. Like if somebody was, because it just was empathetically, it just touched me. But I went to the bathroom in Brooklyn Tech, and the guys from Westinghouse, one of the vocational schools, would sneak in and rob the smart kids, and all the Asian kids would be the smart kids and Asian kids and Indian kids. And they caught me in the bathroom. I had got a watch for my birthday, and the guy tried to take my watch, and I was like, I'm not, no. He pulled the knife out on me, and then I'm trying to think, oh, yeah, here it is. The guy went to stab me in the face, put my hand up, the knife went in my arm. They got blood was everywhere. They got crazy. I went home, didn't tell my mother, had no kind of first aid skill, took the knife, I put wrapped a t-shirt around it, came home. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She goes, hey, how was school? Fine. I got homework to do, which she should have known something was wrong, but I never did the homework. And we had a brownstone, but a sandstone and brick house. Mm-hmm. That my father bought probably in the 1950s. Him and his sister bought the house. And I went up in the bathroom, and I just spent hours trying to stop the blood. Got the blood stopped. And then my dad I won't say he was a war hero, but he was killing Nazis. And he had this huge Nazi dagger that he used to keep under the bed. I took the knife, stuck it in my JanSport, and I went to school every day looking for the guys. But the knife was, like magic, right. a hip dagger, right?
It's like a Crocodile Dundee.
Almost like a bayonet, like the length of a bayonet, like that. So sticking out the top, my pop comes home, he sees the knife. What are you doing? And so super, very masculine dude, so you don't lie to him. I said, they tried to rob me and I got stabbed. I told you. They transferred me from Brooklyn Tech and sent me to Bishop Laughlin Catholic High School. I went to Bishop Laughlin. They, right on the winter recess, got me in. And then I was like, I'm really going to be who I want to be. So I would speak up. Hi, how you doing? My name is so-and-so. As soon as somebody fucked with me, I would instantly fight. So here's the thing, I think this is an inside black thing. If you're a light skin guy in the black community, there's a lot of colorism because white supremacy has trained you that lighter is better. And so if you're
just for the listeners who aren't seeing this, you're a light skinned black guy, you pass as Latino,
Spanish.
Even
if it's funny because any movie that I've ever done, I've never played a black dude.
Yeah.
I've played New Zealand, Fiji, Puerto Rican, Dominican. Just never played a black dude. Yeah. So, but if you were a light-skinned guy and you were fairly good-looking and shit, then it was automatically in the hood, they would think that you were a pussy. So you would get unwanted. They would try to think they could rob you and this and that. And that was like, that was just the thing. Bronx, Queen, I mean, you are light skinned dude. Because the guy, the dark skinned guy with the scar or the ugly dude making it, it was always assumed that he looked like he could fight. But I was very aware of what this. So the minute somebody would say something to me, I would clock them. I would crack them. And what I realized was, oh, everybody's scared. Like, all of this is a facade.
Yes.
Deep down, nobody wants to smoke. And if you're willing to take the first punch, because what, you know, even when you're in an argument with people, it's like, you say this, I say this, this, this. We're both kind of looking for an off ramp, or we're hoping one of us backs down.
Right.
So we go from level to level of what I knew that was the way in which, you know, human beings interacted. So you said something to me, I said something back, you said something to me, and I'd crack you in the mouth. And it would be like, whoa, wait a minute,
we're supposed to keep going back and forth. And then my mother's supposed to call and go, wait,
somebody breaks it up, or whatever. Yeah, and I would be like, nah, I'd crack you and go, all right, now what the fuck is up?
Yeah.
And then everybody was like, yo, he's crazy. Like, just, and then it got to be that nobody really wants to smoke. And so that you get this reputation where you're like, oh, this motherfucker's, what's wrong with him? But it was all calculated. It was me really just fighting my fear.
So, right, because you didn't really want to get in those confrontations, and so
no, but if it was going to happen, I wanted to be in control. And, of it.
Well, yeah, that's smart at that age to be able to think through that on those levels, because what you're saying to yourself is, well, if I throw the first punch and I make my mark here, it'll send a message. Don't fuck with this guy, and then I won't have to deal with being afraid of having to fight people because I don't really want to fight people.
Right. And the fight is on. So this is something else I used to say this when I was like 14 years old. I don't think I maybe didn't understand it, but fear exists between the time when the opportunity is presented and how long you take to access the opportunity. So guy says something to you, you say something back, boom, 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 boom. The longer you wait to act, the more difficult it is. Same thing like I would go to a dance and there'd be some pretty girl. And I would not ask. Before you know, they turn the lights on, the party would be over and I wouldn't have asked. So when I would go to a party, I would go see an attractive girl. Wow, she's cute. I would walk over to her. You want to dance? And she, like, it was almost like she took my forwardness as confidence, but it really wasn't. I was scared to death. I just knew if I didn't right away,
you would torture yourself, and you didn't want to put yourself through the torture. It was like pick your poison, right? Yeah.
You have to do that when you're sitting and you're wallflower, and you just, I'm gonna go, and the longer you wait, the bigger. Which is funny because I remember taking physics in high school, and you remember inertia, the things in motion tend to stay in motion, things at rest tend to stay. And it just, I was like, oh, this is this thing. You take a boulder and you drop it in the sand. The longer it sits in the sand, the harder it is to move. Whereas if the boulder drops and you can actually move it while it's bouncing. And so I even at a young age, I started putting this kind of philosophical under like that. I started understanding that things. So whenever the opportunity presented, I would access it immediately. And then what I realized, the second thing I realized was everybody's afraid. Hmm. Nobody really wants to step up, right? But you can train yourself to step up. And so it got to be like, a guy would be like, yo, who the fuck is this motherfucker? They would piss. And so in the Black community, you like, and they call you piss colored or yellow motherfucker or something like that. And they go, piss color motherfucker, and I would just hit a dude. Or it got to the point where, yo, who's this this pretty motherfucker or something like that? And everybody would go, don't do it, please.
Yeah.
You don't, I don't give a fuck. Yo, I'm just, please, don't, right? And so I got to be this guy who was just, you know, and I think I really got off on it too. Like I really got off on the fact that, you know, I could part the Red Sea, you know. Yeah.
Did that hurt you socially? Were people hesitant to like befriend you because they were afraid or intimidated by you?
No, because I was a good guy. I was still smart. I was a smart kid because I was a good dude and I was a good friend. But it was a weird anomaly. Like I didn't fit into like that kind of street thing where a guy would wear 8-ball jackets and shell top Adidas and stuff like that. Because my dad would have never bought me that stuff anyway, because he wouldn't want me to get shot. I mean, because we're talking about 70s, yeah. 80s. You would be on a train and a guy would put his shoe, his foot next to your sneaker to measure your size to steal your sneakers. You get off the train and they would steal your sneakers or steal your Timberlands, or they would put their arm next to your jacket and measure the sleeve length to see if it's fucking savage, you know? So if a guy could do this, this was something guys would come up and, yo, what size shoes you wear? And your answer would be my size, motherfucker. And then it would that, like, this was an anybody that would tell you from my era, that was it, I could tell any 50-year-old dude, yo, what size are those? And he'll go, my size, motherfucker. That was the answer. So I'm in college and where even the thug dudes, like, oh, this motherfucker's crazy.
Yeah.
Started lifting weights. I got a growth spurt just before I went to college. I was still fencing. So I'm like this anomaly dude who's fencing. I'm smart, but I'm not. But I'm still in the streets. I got both parents, but I'm running with drug deals. I'm in pink houses. I'm in East New York. Like, I'm... Then I come home and, hi, Mr. Johnson, you need help with your groceries? Like this kind of enigma thing. I'm getting stabbed and I'm crazy gluing my...
You're walking around with giant bayonets going...
It's just insane, right? It's funny, as I was talking to somebody today and they said, how many fights do you think you had in your lifetime, right? And it was like, I'm not an ego guy. So it just was kind of, somebody fucks with you, you deal with it, you know? So I never even thought of it. And I can remember 5 in elementary school, right? Which is, I know guys that went through elementary, never had a fight. Or maybe they have one incident, right?
Yeah.
And elementary school was 1 to 8 for us because I went to Catholic school, right? Mm-hmm. Altar boy, the whole, just an enigma of absurdities. And then I'm taking martial arts and, I'm dabbling in martial arts. I go to college, I run into a dude, and then I come back from college. I didn't finish. I started working with mostly disturbed kids. I was way too young to do that. I was a primary house parent. In a group home at around, I was like 19, which is way, I lied about my age. I got the job.
Why did you want that job?
It was good money. And it was, that's what everybody did. You know, either that or you worked retail, you know, you had no skills and it was good money. Plus you could work, like I would work 3 days on and 3 days off. But I got attached to this one kid that was rough, like kind of like from Poughkeepsie. I was up in Poughkeepsie. Mm-hmm. And I would leave from New Paltz, go to Poughkeepsie and stay there for 3 nights. And I had taken a job as a dishwasher in an Italian restaurant. A guy who moved from Mama Leone's. Remember Mama Leone's in New York was there and she said, "Hey." Yeah. And because you're from the Bronx, right?
Initially. No, I'm from Rhode Island, New England. Yeah.
Okay. So you know Arthur Avenue was the Bronx.
Oh, yeah.
Sheepshead Bay was the Italian area of Brooklyn. And this guy goes to Wappinger Falls, New Paltz, and opens a high-end Italian restaurant with milk-fed veal, a rigatoni with the 4G, and the place is hemorrhaging money. I get a job as a dishwasher. The cook quits the day that I come on. He's the maitre d'. He starts cooking. I end up moving up from cook to soup, salads and bread to sous chef until I'm actually cooking. I'm the head cook there. No skill.
Okay. I love it.
And an Italian dude who is, you can't do nothing right. There's no matter how perfect it is, it ain't perfect enough, yelling all the time. But I'm in college And at the end of the night, whatever was left over, we would eat. And, you know, in college, you're starving.
People eating
Vienna Franks and boiled eggs. Doug, I'm eating calamari rigatoni with four cheeses, chicken cacciatore, and I'm fucking... I get my boy to do the dishwasher. He ends up moving to sous chef. He gets his boy. Now the whole kitchen is black, right? And he's going, go back in the kitchen. You go back in. He's screaming and hollering because it's all black dudes from Newark and Brooklyn and shit running the kitchen. But I learned how to cook. My mom, I kind of knew how to cook already because my mom is from the South. These are descendants of slaves. Her dad is 100% Sioux. And my dad is West Indian. I say he's coconut and cornbread. Like he's, but my grandmother was half Irish, half black at a time where she grew up in an orphanage because you couldn't be half and half. But she could actually pass for white, gray eyes, right. Very, very fair skin. And so I had this kind of, so I had, my mom taught me how to fry chicken and do collard greens. My dad taught me what we call cuckoo, which is kind of like salt fish. And so I knew how to cook. And then I went and learned Italian. And then once you get them, you start to understand it. So I knew how to cook. Mm-hmm. And I'm at this restaurant and I'm fencing and I'm a weird kind of thing, so I'm super honest, like goofy honest. I'm in college, I'm with this girl who clearly is for the streets. she was fucking everybody, but she was my girl. Every time I went home, she was in somebody's room, I would hear some. And I ended up, long story short, it was girls, I wasn't even aware that girls liked me. Mm-hmm. Like I was so kind of dealing with my own shit. And I remember going to, like, they had the sweet style in New Paltz. And they're like, take your shirt off. Now I'm ripped, huge. Take your shirt off. Make your chest jump. And I was like, how could I, what would I look like? How could I tell my girlfriend that I had my shirt? Just goofy. Find out that she's cheating on me. Next day I get drunk. I'm running around the tub. You want to see my shirt? I got my shirt off. I'm drunk. They're running around. We're chasing each other around. I'm throwing them on the bed. They're playing, wrestling. And then all of a sudden, I hear like heavy breathing. I'm like, I go up one shirt. She lets me. I go up the other shirt. I'm 18, 19 years old. My first threesome, right? I go to my first threesome. And this is how goofy I was, Paul. I was so upset because I was wanted to just, so the next day I was looking for them because I just wanted to assure them that I wasn't going to tell anybody that I was, this is not what I do. And I find, and there, I can't find them all day, right? They're ducking me. I run into one, I go, hey, I just want you to know I would never tell anybody. I would never. And she goes, would you ever do it again? And I'm like, fuck yeah, I would. And she goes, no, I mean with me. And she goes, I go, yeah. So I run into the other girl. Same thing. Would you ever do it again? Yes. I mean with me. I said, yeah, I would. But your roommate also approached me and said, would I ever do it again? So I don't want to be dishonest. I was in, that's crazy, yeah. But goofy, you know what I mean? I wasn't pimping it or nothing.
No.
And she was like, well, what did you tell her? I told her, yeah. And she goes, well, I don't care. If she don't care, I don't care. And I went back and told her. I was like, well, your roommate said I just wanted to be fair. And she was like, well, if she don't care, I don't care. Then I ran into my girlfriend. She's like, I want to be with you. Same thing. I go back to the other two. Listen, my girlfriend wants to see with me too. I just want to let you know that that's, you know, what. Well, if she don't mind. So now I'm going to fencing class and the three girls are coming to my fencing practice One's got a sandwich. One's got an apple. One's got an apple juice. and the upperclassmen are going, who is this fucking guy? Really, I'm just so goofy and honest about it. I just...
They sense you're a good guy and they know you're a good guy.
And they also... The other thing is what I say is you create a bidding war. Like, it really wasn't about me. It was about them not... You know what I'm saying? It really had nothing to do with me.
So did you guys like, were you doing foursomes with these three or twosomes with threesomes?
Well, twosomes and switch up, but I moved off campus and I was living with these three girls, but which is why I have no degree. Of course, why I didn't get a degree. Anyway, one of the kids that I was working at the restaurant. I got a job as a primary house parent. I get attached to this kid. He has no parents, nobody. I'm on the holidays. I'm taking him home with me. So he has family and he's staying at my house for Christmas and shit. But he was like an aggressive kid. And this is how you know the system is. The more they write up on a kid, the more money they get. But if they write too much, they send the kid off to a sanitarium and then he's on Ritalin. And I lost track of the kid. Couldn't find him anywhere. When I did find him, he was doing the Ritalin shuffle, just drooling and stuff. They had him so heavily. And it just cracked me, dropped out of school. I went back. I go back to Brooklyn.
Is this where you start strip bouncing and then stripping?
Yeah. Well, so I became a frat boy. I'm a Q dog. I'm an Omega Psi Phi Q dog. Yeah. They have a thing. I broke up with those girls. I moved in with another girl. We almost got married. I say I want to, you know, I could probably make money stripping. She was like, you should do it. Each one of the black, what they call the Divine Nine, which is the nine top black fraternities, Omega, Kappa, Sigma. They have the guys are represented for Toys for Tot, Male Review. They get a guy to do it. He backs out. They ask me to jump in last minute. I'm out of my mind already.
So you do it. Right? So you do it.
I do it. A guy who comes since the other dudes.
Wait. Now, what was it like? Hang on. Wait. What was it like when you did it? And did you go, oh man, I want to do this more? Like, because you ended up doing it for 11 years, just so listeners
understand. Right. So I did it. They had one on my campus.
Right.
And it was people that I know. And then they had one in the city. So, like, on spring break, they had another one on spring break. And somebody told them that I had done it. And I was afraid. I was definitely afraid. But I was with a girl who was very emotionally abusive. Parents used to beat each other and stuff. And so she was very verbally abusive. Like, her and her sister would argue like this. Like, she'd go, bitch, you wore my sweater? And she would go, yeah, so what? And then her sister would, that's why you had an abortion. And you'd be like, whoa, like, what?
Well, you know, from 0 to 60, right? Wow.
And she was just very abusive, emotionally abusive. My self-esteem is, I'm like, if I can't be with her. And then I go home and I start stripping. Now I'm hanging out with this girl. She's telling me I ain't shit. I'm dancing in front of 300-400 women.
Damn, now, are you dancing because of the money, because of the adulation? You get off on it? Like, what is it about?
First, I had dropped out of school and I hadn't done anything. I was like, this would be a great.
So you needed the money. So you needed the money.
Yeah. Right. And I wasn't doing nothing. My mom, I'm sitting on the couch. I'm depressed about this kid. I do it. But then there's this disconnect between women chanting my name. So my stripper name was Prince Mandingo, right? So I know people use that as a terminology now, but I was the first guy. We're talking about 89, 88. So I don't know if you remember Maceo.
Yeah.
The comic.
Yeah.
So remember when they did Uptown Comedy Club?
Yeah.
They had when Kevin Brown and I. So they used to do him and Flex Alexander used to do this thing. I am the real Mandingo. They would go back and forth like that. That was because they knew about me. Like, it was we're talking about 89, 90. Like,
now,
that.
What is this like for you? Like, are you getting laid whenever you want as a stripper? Like, are you just now getting out of control?
I'm still with my girl. I break up with my girl because there's a disconnect between these women yelling my name and her telling me I ain't shit. And I'm like, something wrong here.
Yeah.
Now I'm in it. And there's women, it's just insane. It's like, even if you're not the best looking guy, just the environment itself creates a
situation.
And it's
going to be hard to walk away, because the more you get that adulation, and you're even halfway good at it, like you said, you just keep going, right? You don't know when to stop. Yeah.
But I also was like philosophical. So when I did it, did you ever watch wrestling?
Yeah, when you were younger? Wrestling. Yeah.
Okay, so remember how wrestling was in the beginning? You had region before there was Vince McMahon. So stripping was the same way. You had Bronx, Queens dancers, Brooklyn dancers, and never the Twain Show Me. There were a few guys that superseded the boroughs because they were just built amazing or had a following that they crossed over. But if you hooked up with it. So what I did was when I first started, I went to the top guys. Oh, man, I was just gassed. I was like, oh, man, I'm such a big fan. Yo, one day I could hope I could be like, oh, I'll take you under my wing. And I would do that in Queens, Bronx, Brooklyn, and Manhattan. And then, so what it is you do your stage show. And then after your stage show is like two or three records. And then you go out in the crowd and you just mull around the crowd and make tips. So they would never pay me, but they would say you could come and tip out, like where you could just go in the crowd and get tips, get oil up, you put your costume on and you get tips. I would go when everybody was just getting money. I would go and do my stage show in the middle of the floor after the show was over. And I would do a full stage show and they would be like, who the fuck is this guy? And then I would hand out my business card. Right. They'd be like, why wasn't you on a regular show? Well, if you want me, tell the promoter. And I did that for a year, just dance for free, handed out cards. Everybody left with a card. But in a year's time, they were like, we want to see what happened. How come you don't have Mandingo on the show? Plus, I started making private shows. Girls would hire me for bachelorette parties. Yeah. Then I got on the big shows. Then I put a group together, 16 members on the group. And I had this idea. So we had these long, they were all like kind of nobodies. And we all had these long Western dusters, kind of like Tombstone.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody had a black hat. You could wear any black hat you wanted, but it had to be a black hat. And it had the logo on the back. I had a graffiti artist did the logo. The group was called Wet Seduction. He did a crazy logo. He actually does comic books, independent comic books. Like, I was an amazing artist. And then you had your name and it was like personal, your own character. So I was the African warrior and somebody else guy did a nerd. He would act dress up like
and,
a nerd.
And you're taking the show around to all of the boroughs.
They're working already in the business. I take them. I'm the only one that's booked because I had put all these cards out and I would have them meet at my house. And then we would all go to my show 13 deep with these black dusters. So imagine you're on Fifth Avenue and we get our black hats. It's 13 of us with black dusters with the low. Who the fuck are these? And then they would all come with me. I would go, hey, it's going to take me some time to get dressed. Why don't you put one of my guys up? Just give them a little something and let them work for tips. And I would get them exposure. And then they would go and warm up and then hand out their cards, right? Mm. And then I would tell them to take their shirts off, their hat on, oil up, and I would have them carry me out above. They would hold me,
of course
carry
you did.
Me out, and they'd lay me on the floor. And then they would all be standing there by the DJ booth, all oiled them up. So you can imagine. Everybody, anytime you see it, it's such a spectacle.
Yeah.
People are going, who the fuck?
You have to become addicted to that because now you're being carried out by 13 guys and people are cheering. like, how do you not?
And then I was a club head. I was a house head. So I could dance. So it was like you had big guys who were could had great bodies, and you had little guys who could dance that had no body. And I was the perfect midway between. I had a good body, but I could move and I could dance. And I, plus I was martial arts. I could flip and all kinds of shit. And then it got to the point where those guys couldn't come to my shows. They wouldn't come with me anymore because right. they had their own shows, right? Which is what I wanted to do anyway.
Yeah.
It's get them their own. And so now there's not, like in the 90s, there's no party without, there's no black party anywhere without a stripper. You have a male, even if it's just guys, regular party, you have a male stripper and a female stripper.
So you're getting a lot of work. And do you mind my asking, like at your peak, do you mind my asking, like what were you, sure. what were you pulling down on at your peak when you were really cooking with
so
this?
I would do 100 and at my peak, like 250 a show, right? Uh-huh. But on a Friday, I would do anywhere from 5 to 7 shows. Saturday, I would do 5 to 7 shows. Sunday, I would do 2 from 1 to 3. And then during the week, what I would do is I taught my guys how to negotiate, or I would go in and negotiate a deal. So each one of them had some little club somewhere where they had 2 dances on a Wednesday and 2 right. dances on a. And so all 13 guys had a room where they were siphoning money off that. They were getting $100 off, or they were getting $100 or 125, and they were taking 50 and they were paying 75. And so we were working 7 days a week.
And you have injuries now. You mentioned it, like you have injuries now from it, right? You got bad back.
Oh yeah, because I would pick a 400-pound woman. I would throw a 400-pound woman up in the air easily, like this. And you just think you're never gonna run out, you know? And like your back.
And by the way, you were doing shows as a stripper, like we do as comics. You do 2, 3, 4 shows a night, bounce from club to club, get in, you know. 10 shows in three nights or whatever. Yeah.
And then handing out my cards.
And are you sort of at this point going, okay, I got to start moving on from this. And then how did, because you give this great relationship advice, which before we end, we'll tell people where to go. But like, what did you learn? Cause you're so smart and intuitive about relationships, and because of all of this experience that you have, foursomes, threesomes, right? Like, what did you learn from stripping? And you're a bouncer too, which is another kind of job where you learn about human behavior that you take in, you use in sort of giving advice.
Okay, so as a stripper, you are the object. Instead of, like, women are usually the object. But as a stripper, you are the pursuant. Like, you're the person, they're pursuing you. So I literally remember doing a gig out in Long Island where they hired me to do this girl. She's getting married the next day. This is her bachelorette party. I'm getting dressed in this bathroom in the basement. The bride comes in and she starts blowing me she's getting married the next day. We get busted.
Well, just in fairness, you are Prince Mandingo, so who wouldn't come on, you know what I mean?
We get busted by her mother-in-law, right? By her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law, I always say that, you know, this is her mother-in-law says, "You funky bitch, you in here sucking dick and didn't call me." And then they both blow me in this bathroom. And I am flabbergasted. Like, to think that women would even, you know, like my perception of women, you know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She worked for women of the rosary. She was like, she in church, she was the Mother Mary of the rosary. They would go around and so for me to see, so now I'm fucking this dude's getting married tomorrow, and I'm fucking his mom and his wife. Mind blowing, right? So, but you're the pursuant, and so in order to understand in order to make money, you have to understand how women perceive attraction, how they, that you're communicating value,
right?
And but you're communicating value in a subtext because you are the pursuant, which is the same thing like a pretty girl. A pretty girl is so used to guys, you know, like when you, excuse me, miss, you dropped your, listen, I don't want to be bothered, bitch, your wallet. You dropped your wallet. And then she's on it. And she's so, but I would, it was like that for me. Like, guys, I would literally like end up, whatever my last show was, that's the burrow I would sleep in. I would literally, right, I'm going with you. And I would just, right, sit many a day, had a brick through my car window, like guys knew. So now I'm a stripper, and I have, and then there's the whole female stripper community, because we got them work and they got us work. They're all working at a club in Brooklyn called the Cheetah Club.
Now, would you guys sleep with each other? This is the male strippers.
Of course. Yeah.
Why not?
Debauchery. Yeah. Just debaucherous exactly. Behavior.
It's like Rome. It's like Rome.
This is crazy, because right around the time Giuliani started cleaning up New York, right? He had finished with the South Street Seaport. Now he was cleaning up, making Disney on 42nd Street. Sent out all these vice people. So there was all these rules and regulations, and he had undercover vice closing clubs down if you didn't follow. Because like if you were all nude, I don't know if you remember this. If you were all nude, you couldn't have alcohol, right? Remember, it was just a juice bar, right? Yep. Remember the Gramercy was half. Yeah. And then there was a rule, if you had an adult business, you also had to have a legitimate business. So there was a lot of comedy clubs that were half strip clubs, half comedy clubs or whatever. Anyway, there's a club where they would do these locked door parties, lock the doors, and there would be just basically a roving brothel. And Giuliani starts sending the guy and the girls, even on the weekdays, the girls would turn tricks in the club. You know how they say no sex in the champagne room? There was all the sex. And they just pull it to the side and they would turn tricks. And the guy says, listen, the girls respect you. Why don't you manage my club? You got to keep them from fucking us. So now every day I'm working a shift, he's paying me money on the week. Stop fucking in the club. Stop.
Are they then listening to, like, you? Are they listening
no,
to you?
No, not at all. Not at all. And then I was like, look, you guys want to fuck, let's just take it out of the club. So now I'm a pimp outside of the club. I've got these girls and I'm getting them work. They like me. It's just debauchery. So I'm a pimp and I'm stripping. So I have both perspectives. I know.
Did you have any kind of moral dilemma with any of that? Like, were you sort of like?
Eventually, that's why I stopped. That's why I stopped. I had a girl who, it was some drug dealers to hide girls. And I used to say, you know, because you also got to knuckle up. If somebody roughs them up, you got to go take care of that. So it really is a relationship, right? Mm. And they were going to fuck anyway. So I was like, all right, I'll just manage it. You know, right. now I'm living with 11 girls and we're traveling, going to be just insanity. But I have so one of the girls didn't listen. She went, I sent her with some drug dealers. And here's a funny thing, because I got a call from this guy, Peter Hsu. Now, you're not going to know Peter Hsu, but you do know Madonna. Do you remember when Madonna was involved with somebody selling a couple of keys, who was involved with the DEA back in the days? It was the connect from Madonna. And this guy got caught up with selling.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you could Google it. But Peter Hsu was my dude. He had my girls go out to see these drug dealers. And I said, make sure y'all come back together. There was one girl who, the head guy, his name is, I won't even say his name. But anyway, he's like, why don't you just stay with me? They can go back. She stayed. He passes out. They rape her, break a Moet bottle, and they hold it to the neck, and all these guys rape her. And then I was like, I'm out. I'm not going to. So even when guys would go yo, I got a bachelor party. Can you get me some? I was like, I wouldn't even recommend.
So now you're at a crossroads, right? Because you're like, well, what are my skill sets? I can cook, I can be a bouncer, I can strip, but where do you go next? Because before we wrap up, I want to talk about how you're using all these experiences to do your man school and everything.
Right. So what happens is I'm in love comedy. I'm producing male reviews as well. I did one with 4,000 women once. First guy to strip at Tavern on the Green. I stripped at Tavern on the Green. Somebody hired me. I get a toothache. I take a job with the phone company. It's for the dental. 94. But Def Jam breaks, and I start to take comics, Tracy Morgan, Mike Epps. I put them up early on the shows. They warm up the shows, then the strip show. So I'm in now. Oh, I love comedy.
Okay, that's how you go. Okay.
So I'm producing comedy shows on the Chitlin Circuit side. And I know Tracy and Mark Theobald and all of those guys. And then I'm working at the phone company, a legitimate job. And then around 99, 2000, I was really afraid to do comedy because comedy, you're emotionally naked.
Yeah.
Stripping, you're physically naked. It's a little more. And I didn't think anybody would take me seriously. It's a little more involved, but 2000, I start doing comedy. I'm still working at the phone company, but I have connections and I start doing comedy and I'm doing that. I meet Patrice. We do.
Patrice
he's
O'Neil,
on Opie and Anthony.
Who yeah. passed away. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. He's on Opie and Anthony.
He and I used to go on Opie and Anthony together a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And he would always talk about girl stuff and stuff, but he knew, it was funny because I never really talked about this. If you know about it, you know, I just came on as Dante. I use my real name. I didn't use Prince Mending. He's fucking some chick. And he goes, do you remember I had a stripper named Mandingo and she loses her shit? Oh my God, I love it. 45. He calls me up. He's in bed with her. And he goes, you know this funky ass bitch? He right, I'd mentioned your name. She hasn't been stopped talking about you since. He goes, why didn't you tell me? I go, it's in the past. It doesn't matter. He was like, well, I apologize because I didn't know. She won't stop talking about you, right?
Patrice O'Neill apologizes to you. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. He was like, man, I didn't know. he starts doing this show on Opie and Anthony called, they had the virus. Remember they used, on Saturdays, different dudes would do shows. And we do this thing called the Black Phillip Show. We called it bitch management. And we would just talk about relationships. This is right around the time we started with the grandfathers of that whole red pill era.
Right.
And he brought me on because he knew what my background was. And Billy and all of those guys were mad at Billy Berg, Keith and Bobby were all mad. Why would you do it? Because I'm younger than them in comedy anyway. Yeah. But yeah. I've lived five lives already, right?
Yeah.
And he brought me on and we started doing the Black Phillip Show. That becomes a cult classic online. And then he passes away. I pick up the mantra I missed him. And I it was called Black Phillip because Opie says, you're like the Black Dr. Phil. Mm. And he goes, yeah, Black Phillip, right? It was the joke. And then I pick it up and I call it Beige Phillip because I'm light skinned. And I continue doing the podcast. And then now I'm working at a blue collar job where guys make $150,000, $180,000, build a house for their wife, and then not getting their dick sucked and not getting having sex, sexless marriages and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, my wife this, my wife. They're everybody's going, happy life, happy wife. And I'm going, no, because I literally had girls selling pussy for me. So if I can do that, it's easy to get your wife to shut up during the Super Bowl. I could do that in my sleep, right? And so I would give out advice. And then, you know,
did it work? Was the advice working? Was it good advice?
Like I was I'll tell you, you know how you keep, well, let me ask you this. How many women do you think you slept with in your lifetime? If you know,
me?
Before you got married? Yeah.
Not many. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. Half a dozen, not a lot. I wasn't a guy. Yeah.
All right. So I used to keep, you know, we keep track. I kept track up until I was 32, right? At 32, I was at like 1,400 by 32.
Oh my
and
God.
That's, I stopped counting then, right?
Did I say half dozen? I meant 3,200. That's what I meant.
But I mean, it doesn't even matter. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I always look at, it was the situation I was in.
Yeah.
And then I was also, I didn't say, like, I had gotten over fear, so I didn't mind asking. Like,
So you had all of this experience between pimping, stripping, all these women you were fucking. You were basically, without the actual degree from college, you had a street degree in relationships and psychology around relationships.
And imagine all of those relationships. And it's not, I'm not just saying like one, like I've only had 2 1 night stands in my life where I just slept with the girl and she was gone. They all were like weeks or months and they would overlap. So it was insane. And you have such a wide scope of the control group that you see the patterns. And so, but you also see the patterns in human beings. Like it's the difference with me is that I saw the patterns of what women do. And women, all women think they're different. They think that they're different, that they're so unique. They're not. All men don't think that they're different, but they're absolute human beings are human beings. Moreover than that, I used to say,
wait,
this
men, time. Men, you're saying men think they're different, but they aren't.
Men
women
don't
think
care. Men okay, don't care. It. They don't care about it, but they don't consider it. But they're not different. And women swear they're different, and they're not different at all. They do the same shit. I always used to say this: if people were so different, how come nobody has ever taken a shit and faced the tank? Right? Like we all sit the way it's supposed. And think about it, that's a desk. You can write jokes. You can take notes. You can eat a sandwich. But nobody ever does that because we're so alike. You know, they say we're 99% chimpanzees, you know,
why do you think that we want to think we're different, but we're not? What? Because
we want to be special. We want to be special.
Yeah.
We want to be validated, but we're not. I mean, everybody does the same thing. I used to tell guys this. You get to a girl, you get a girl, she likes you. You get her home, and then there's these things, these obstacles, why she doesn't want to fuck you.
Right.
I would say, how many times have you ever had somebody, a girl come to your house and then object? Not object, but she would go, you don't even know me. You don't know my favorite color. I go, how many times has a girl ever said something unique that you never heard before?
You're talking about bringing her back. You want to sleep with her, and she starts giving you all
and
of these.
And she
like,
wants to. She wants to sleep with you,
but she's giving you all the lines. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then your point is all the girls say the same thing.
They all say the same. I've never done this. I don't do this on a second date. I don't know. So, but, and I used to tell guys, if you're going to school and you know there's going to be a test and I give you the answers, why would you not prepare the answers? But it's the same, right?
Yeah.
So why would you, she says the same thing that the girl that from 6 months ago said,
the answer works every time. Just say the same answer.
It's the same question because the apprehension is, I want to have sex with you, but because of society's norms that puts the social pressures on me, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
Like you're coercing me. And so why not just have the answers?
Yeah.
So,
and that's what you started to do. Yeah. And you start
to see these patterns. You start to see these patterns. That every human being are exactly alike. I mean, there's nuances to everybody, there's trauma. I mean, I also didn't really think about that when I was younger, but, you know, as I'm older, then you factor in trauma.
Yeah.
You factor in personal trauma and things, but even the trauma is typical.
Kind of repeats itself. Yeah.
You know, you got a parent that supported you. You got a parent that beat you. You got a parent that said you
were emotionally abusive. Yeah. All that stuff. Yeah.
Neglectful.
So tell people, tell people where, we got to do more of this and get into the man school stuff show, but, tell them where they can go and get consultations from you and, check out your podcast and everything.
Okay. My podcast is Man School 202. You can get it everywhere. You can find podcasts. It's also on YouTube, the video and stuff. I started doing video a couple of years ago. You're on in the next episode too, which is dope. You want a consultation with me, go to DonCanyonRoe.com, click on consult. I consult women. I consult men. I've done couples. I mean, it's just human beings, the human condition. I mean, we're both comics. What's funny is that what makes it funny, everything is funny. That's funny. It's funny because of the human condition. It's like,
because once you it's understand based in human, truth. Yeah. It's relatable.
It's based in truth.
And your advice is really good.
Yeah. Thank you, bro. Thank
you, man. This has been a blast. I love you. I think you're the sweetest man on the planet. I told you this on your show. Man. When I walk into a club and I see you, I smile because you just give off a vibe. You're one of the great ones, man. So
you're one of the greatest dudes I know. I really feel a really good feeling when I see you, man. I'm going to make an effort. We should be better friends.
Yeah.
We should talk.
We should do that.
Let's do that. Let's do that.
All right.
Dante Nero. Let's get a meal. Let's go get a meal.
Let's do it. Dante Nero, Man School 202. Love you, brother.
Love you, bro. Later.
All right. Dante Nero, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope to see you guys August 18th, Glastonbury, Connecticut. Should be a really fun gig. And we will see y'all next week.